Coming up on Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway, we speak with Harvey Schmidt. We also talk about Encore's production of The Cradle Will Rock, the Nymph productions of Life Could Be a Dream, Julian Poe, and The Swiss Family Robinson, so please stay tuned.
You only need $100 in advance. In 24 hours, you'll have rain.
You mean it? Real rain?
Real rain. Rain's rain, brother. It comes from the sky. A wetness known as water. Aqua pura. Mammals drink from it. Fish swim around in it. Little boys wade in it. Birds flap their wings and sing a song like sunrise. Water! Woo! I recommend Cumulo. Cumulo Nimbo.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Monday, July 15th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI Critchlin, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places around the internet. Also joining us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com and many other places on the internet. With us this evening, we have Harvey Schmidt, who, if I can be so bold to say, is a legend in this industry. We know Harvey, of course, for The Fantastics and 110 in the Shade and I Do, and Celebration and Colette and Bad Company, and the show goes on, as we might say, and Roadside as well. But Harvey, thank you so much for joining us from down in Texas.
Oh, it's my pleasure, except we just finished having a big rainstorm. But I think the worst is over because it had a tornado cloud when it was headed this way. But I think it's calmed down now.
Well, I called Harvey last week to set this up, and I think you had the radio on in the background, and I think I heard them say that the temperature was 101.
Oh, so
yes,
close.
It has been like that. It hasn't been 110 yet, but we seem to be working in that direction.
Speaking of 110.
Yes.
Can you tell us about the title song? There has been a lot of speculation that you guys wrote a title song after the Broadway show had ended. I've heard a song called 110 in the Shade. I'm told it went in London, that it was in the finale. Is this true?
Well, it was, because the producer over in London was simply demanding it. He had already made the agreement and gotten it all worked out and everything. But so via David Merrick, he said that he didn't care about doing it, but this producer in London said it would help the show a lot if we did it. So we first just sort of rebelled, but then we decided we'd give it a whirl. And so we actually did it, and it's buried somewhere in the files here. It was a sort of a rock song. They wanted a song that could be a hit. They had several shows running that had rock title songs at that time. And ours began something like, "It's 110 in the shade. Every dun-dun-dun is getting you down." You see what I'm talking about?
So, Peter, maybe that's not the one you heard.
It is the one I've heard.
Oh, it is the one you've heard.
That's exactly the one I've heard.
I spared you the whole thing. In my senile situation now, I don't think I'd have recalled it all anyway. I could probably recall the notes in it, but not the lyrics.
I remember reading when I was growing up in Boston that this new musical by Schmidt and Jones was coming based on The Rainmaker, and it was called Rainbow. Do you recall that that was one of your working titles while the show was being...
Well, it was the original title of Richard Nash's version of it, and then they got a note from the Rodgers and Hammerstein office that Hammerstein had done a show called Rainbow years and years ago. Did you know that?
Yeah, in 1930, yeah.
Yeah. So they said we couldn't use that. And we had a long struggle trying to get a good title. We were desperate, Tom and I. There was a period where I would send the David Merrick a list every day. Tom and I would play around with titles and just things that we thought were might be better than we ended up with. We never liked 110 The Shade as a title because it's there's something lurid and about it, and it's not somehow it's not what the show's about. But we tried all these variations with Lizzie or Starbucks. Starbucks are good titles, but but it's not what the show is. It's not just sure. about Starbucks, you know.
Sure.
And we didn't really ever have a song title, and so we were getting closer and closer. And David Merrick had told Richard Nash one day that he said he was going to use the title. It was his own title, 110 in the Shade.
Uh-huh.
And so we just went with it. And it's I've never liked it because, I mean, it's not no one's fault. None of us could think of a proper title for it.
Ironically enough.
I'm sorry, what?
Ironically enough, if it were today, it'd be called The Rainmaker, the musical. You know, I mean,
yes, right. And we would have loved that because we loved that original title, and so did Richard Nash.
But in those days, of course, you had to come up with something new to show that you were a brand new item. Today, of course,
yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't remember for the revival, but for the original production, where did it appear in the ABCs? Was it before or at the end?
Was it under?
It might have been because it is the official title is 110 in the Shade.
Uh-huh.
It must have been in the A's, and that was we probably thought that was good, and Merrick certainly would have thought it was good.
I don't remember offhand what they do with number titles, Peter. Do you?
No, I think 1776 that was under S. So, but I don't remember what 100 Shade was. That was before I was reading the Times every day. So,
yeah.
Yeah, so I don't really know that. I have a memory of this, and you can tell me if I'm wrong. But I recall reading when the show was being readied in Variety that Mary Martin wanted to be billed over the title. Period. No Robert Preston over the title at all. He would get billing under the title. Do you recall any of this?
Oh, no, not at all. They were both entranced with doing this piece and with each other. They had met originally when they did one of their earliest movies, a Paramount film called, oh, God, here we go. I can't remember things.
<All right. laughs>
they were both starring at Paramount at that time. And, oh, God, I wish I could think of the title. It's a good title, actually.
I'll
look it up. They had a wonderful experience then at that time, very early. And, in fact, when on the first day of rehearsal, Mary brought in, she stayed up all night, and she did this wonderful embroidered thing with a still that she gave to everybody connected with the show that had one of the photos from their first movie together. And they... either he or she was handing the other one a good luck charm in the photograph. And so that was a lovely thing to do. I still have that somewhere framed.
My Cup Runneth Over, certainly a wonderful song and got a great many recordings, including Ed Ames, who was certainly an important artist in the Jones and Schmidt catalog.
Yes, we had our two biggest hits with him, and he had his two biggest hits with us.
Right, indeed. I've often wondered, this is one of the comparatively rare songs where there's only an A section. There's no B section to the song.
Mm.
Did you ever give any thought to writing a B section to the song, or...
No, it's always just remained that way because it was immediately via Ed Ames' recording. It was a very popular song. At that time, I remember coming down to Texas, and my mother told me various schools here were using it as their class song that year.
Oh.
High school kids. And whenever I'd go around the country or anywhere driving and have the car radio on, they would always end up playing that song. It always amazed me. And there were other recordings then, too, of it. But,
sure. Now, I've noticed in recent productions of I Do, I Do, I've seen it in the second act of the show.
Yes. A few years ago, Tom felt it would pay off more in the second act, that it was we had too much sentimental stuff up at the front, and he thought it would pay off better in the second act, so he changed it at that time, relocated it.
I think he's right, because one thing is, in only a moment we both shall be old, is
that's
something
right.
that older people would think of rather than young people. Young people think they're going to be young forever, you know.
Well,
we get older, we realize in only a moment we both shall be old. So
that's right. Yes, that was a lot of why he felt the movie. And I think it's worked out better, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Harvey, I'd like to ask you about film versions of your shows. I mean, I guess there's only one Hollywood film version of any of your shows, and it's The Fantastics. You've had some TV stuff, some stuff done on TV, including an I Do with Lee Remick and...
Hal Linden,
yes.
Yes.
Do you... I mean, do you, this may sound like a silly question, do you regret that there aren't more Hollywood films of your shows, or do you kind of maybe not regret it because you feel like they were conceived for the stage and it's not, you know,
We'd be open to it, of course, but it's I don't know why there haven't been more. And Gower was working on a version, was very successful on the stage, and so there was interest in getting it as a film, and it was going to be with Gower directing it.
Oh, really?
And so he was working on it with a script writer out in Hollywood at that point, and but then that fell through, and I loved it because we were writing new songs for it. Gower wanted one section where it looks like they're getting rich from his royalties as a writer.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so he scheduled because it was a film, a flight of them in an airplane, one of the very early airplanes at that time, from the 1920s. And it was a real 1920s kind of song. I loved writing it. And it was a song called We're Gonna Be Rich, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And But that song got lost too, like the title song.
That's interesting because I know Gower Champion was also supposed to direct a film version of Carnival, and that never happened either. Unless I'm missing something, we never wound up with a film directed by him. I mean, he did choreography for some things, but that would have been really interesting to see what he would have done with a musical film.
Yeah, we had worked. For quite a while with him as the director on The Fantastics. And we did some really nice work. And we had envisioned it all being photographed in Sicily because I had been over there. And I thought, what a great place to do, just using the countryside that's here, to do a film of The Fantastics.
Oh.
And so we went over there. Paramount put a lot of money into us exploring the idea. And the three of us went over. And we took a lot of photographs of what we were... Our whole screenplay was coming together just really because of the Sicilian atmosphere there. And it was a great trip and everything. But when we came back, it turned out that the head of Paramount at that time, and I can't think of his name now, I can't do 1940s movie stars, and I can't do heads of anything in New York since I've been down here 15 years. I do try to read the New York Times, but for the last 8 years, there's no one I know anymore in the New York Times. And most of them have died. I mean, one reason I take it is to see who died overnight in New York that I once knew. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry I'm straying, but
it's, okay.
It's preventing me from having to think
we
of a title or name.
Harvey, tell us about your trek to and from Texas. You started out in Texas, and you moved to New York and made your mark here. And what drew you back to Texas?
Well, it's funny. I had always loved growing up here, and I had always wanted very much to go to New York. And I loved every single moment I was ever in New York, but I always loved whenever I'd come back to Texas. And I had promised myself... the day that I went to New York, and that by then I'd been in the Army too, and I had that someday I would want to come back. It was very sad for me to actually know I was leaving here and going to live in New York. But I mean, the thrill of being in New York took over, and I had a wonderful several careers there. One, I was a graphic artist working for all the major magazines then at that time, which had a lot of wonderful artwork, and I made a lot of money from that. And Tom and I weren't really working together initially, but he had worked on a, we were sharing an apartment, and we were trying to get a review of our work on at that time. So we were sharing the same apartment, but he was working on a version of that would become the Fantastics, but it didn't have that title at that time. It was a title called Joy Comes the Dead Horse, and he was working on it with the head of music at the University of New Mexico, there was a production done in New Mexico of that, but Tom came back, and he had been very unhappy with it. He asked if I would consider working with him for it. And I said, well, I'm doing a lot of, I'm jammed with all my art things now, because that's really what I thought I'd go there to do. And I never had any idea of being a composer until I met Tom in college. And he had seen an art show of mine, and asked to meet me, and it was a thrill to meet him, because he was head of the Curtain Club at that time. That's how we just started working together, and whenever he would ask me to do a show, I would accept, because he was such a brilliant, bright guy, and I was so impressed with him always. I forgot what tale I'm telling now. I'm running astray again. I remember that Tom Jones is in it, but,
sure.
And I remember his name too.
Well, what led you back to move from New York back to Texas then?
Oh, about I guess 15 years ago now. I was having some health problems with heart problems and serious things, and I also I had never planned where I would go in my later years. I used to spend a lot of time in Italy, and when I was younger, I thought, oh, well, I'll come here and buy a place sometime overlooking the ocean here, which I did a couple of times, renting houses over there when I was working. On I Do, Tom and I wrote most of it over there. Suddenly, I remembered I had bought this house in Tomball, where you hear my very voice speaking from now, and for my parents, because my sister lived here. And they were getting older, and my sister said, we need a place for the parents as they're getting older. And said, you're busy in New York doing things. And my brother was building an atomic power plant south of Dallas.
Wow.
So I said, well, I'll be happy to pay for it if you can find a place that would work for them. So she called one day, and this house that I'm in right now was available. She knew the people who built it. And at that time, Tomball was a tiny little oil town way out from Houston. Now it's become a Houston suburb. It's surrounded by Houston growth here. So I bought this house, and we had to trick my parents sort of into moving into it originally, because they were very happy with the house I'd bought for them in College Station. My sister told them this was just the place Harvey wanted, and she called it the Schmidt Hilton. For family gatherings and things. Because we couldn't really officially move them yet. So the one day I came down and saw it, and I was on the way to meet Gower and Tom in Europe at that point. We were going to work on the screenplay with Gower. But it turned out that was canceled then at the last minute. But I just had one day to get some furniture. So my sister recommended I go to Ethan Allen Furniture, which I'd never heard of at that time.
Uh-huh.
And they have, because she said they have good, sensible things that my parents would like, you know. So I did that. And then during the months, every time they'd come down, there would be a new chair or table or something. And they would laugh and say, look what Harvey sent us, you know. It eventually became a wonderful thing for many years with my parents. My brother and sister had a lot of children, and we'd have spent a lot of holidays here. So it was always here, but they all died a number of years ago. My mother and father and my sister and my brother last year. I'm the only single person left from that family. And so curiously, I thought, well, that's, I've always liked the house here. And I thought, well, I'm just going to go down there and transfer. I needed to add a studio. It didn't have a big studio in back, but I've added that, and it's a huge studio with a skylight. In fact, I was in there a while ago thinking I'd talk to you on the phone, but I thought the panes might come crashing through with thunder or lightning or something. But anyway, you see that my problem is I'm rant and rave in my elderly years, like I always swore I'd never do when I was like,
all right,
this is recent, as 5 years ago.
Then I'll ask you a question about you being a graphic artist, because of course you did so many, if not all, those Ben Bagley albums. You did the covers for those wonderful albums, Rodgers and Hart, Cole Porter, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, well, how nice that you remember them, because I'm assembling. I have, I'm working out of all, going through all my papers here. Tom and I are trying to get all our papers together at the same place. And so I have about three book ideas. One is I'm actually want to write a book about working with Tom in the theater in New York and our whole career, which has some interesting things that are not like other people's careers. Out of very interesting just to talk about. And but also involve the fact that I had this art career going on. Anyway, to get back, I have to get back a moment to the earlier version of Fantastics. And Tom asked if I would just take a chance and work on it. And so I took off a whole year from our career. And that's when we did the bulk of what became the Fantastics Downtown. And anyway, now I forgot what I was talking about a minute ago. What was you've gone to sleep, haven't you?
What, no,
all three of you are sound asleep.
No. I'm ready to ask if Ben Bagley really was incurably insane, the way he said on the back of each of his albums. Do you have fond memories of him?
He was what?
Incurably insane. That's what he used to say.
Yes, he liked to think that about himself. I'm putting together a book that I'd like to be published. It's nothing but all the Ben Bagley drawings I did for many years. And I had known him. We first came to New York and we were trying to get a review on. And I had done some sketches of how we wanted our sets and costumes to work and everything for it. And he remembered those. And he just called one day and he remembered I'd done a drawing of a showgirl or something for our review. And he asked, he said he was going to do this first record album of songs cut and not used anymore by famous Broadway composers. So the first was going to be Rodgers and Hart, and he wanted a showgirl for that. And I just was very busy, and I just didn't have the time, and I told him I would love to do it, but I just couldn't. And he kept calling like every other day, and finally he I guess he did become insane, as he says. And so finally I thought, well, I've just got to do this. And so I sat down, and one morning I got up early, and there was used to be a radio station in New Jersey that played sort of middle-of-the-road kind of music. And they were playing several Richard Rodgers songs, and I thought, oh, my God, Richard Rodgers is my favorite composer of all time. And So I just sat there doing this drawing, and I sent it to Ben, and he loved it. And so I was so pleased to have gotten that. It was driving me insane because I knew I couldn't do it easily. It looks like I do these things easily, but I have to do like six or seven of them before I kind of get one that pleases me, you know. And so I've got that out of my system now, and Ben won't be calling me all the time. Well, a year or two after that, incidentally, that record came out and it was displayed a lot at with my drawing on it at Doubleday Bookstore and places. So I was pleased that I'd done it. And I was pleased that it was Richard Rodgers, too. And one day he called again, like a year or two later, and he said that he was now going to do a Cole Porter revisited, and he needed a drawing. And he didn't tell me all the years what I should do, really, but occasionally he would. He said he wanted a woman with a lot of plumage or feathers or something, and her costume was open in the back, so you would see that she was stark naked, you know. And so, I thought, and I had just gotten my ticket arranged to go down to Texas to visit my parents at the other house at College Station where they were living at that. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't change the dates or anything. So I took my drawing material with me. And I remember the first day I was there, I just wanted to get it out of my life so I could spend time with my parents and pay them more attention. And my mother was doing the laundry. And at that time, people still hung the laundry on the clothesline outside. So I remember sitting there drawing this woman with her bare ass sticking out from the costume with green feathers on. And it was used in the series. and my mother, right out the window, hanging the laundry, you know, the two different worlds. And so I did several other versions of that, too, to Ben. I ended up always through the years, I would do four or five. It was easier than pinning all my hopes on one single drawing, you know. Uh-huh. And more and more. And he would use more and more of them through the years. But there were also a lot that he didn't use. So I'm trying to put together right now this book that would be all the Ben Bagley drawings. It would be a big book. But I'm hoping I can get that done by somebody. I'm doing a dummy version right now. But I have a foreword to it where it explains this whole body of work and how it came to be. And it was always an annoyance to me. It always interfered with what I considered my real life. Mm. But I realized longer and longer, because whenever I'd travel sometime around and meet people from other places like L.A. or something, they had no interest in talking about my shows. It was like the Ben Bagley albums they wanted to know about. They loved the drawings, you know. And I realized...
Done it again.
Huh?
I've done it again, sure, asking about them.
So, Harvey, tell us, you said you're putting together papers for Tom. Are you organizing them in a way that can be donated to a university library, or do you have plans for it, or what's happening?
No, I can't say right now who it is because we're right now in the process of it.
Sure, absolutely.
But I had told my secretary yesterday, who's somebody that's worked for me for 50 years probably, who lives in New York, and I said I was going to mention that. He said, don't you dare mention that to anybody.
Nah.
And I said I was doing this. It's something we both like the idea of. And so Tom has never met the man, but I'm just sending a letter tomorrow, actually, to Tom that I've written to the man about that maybe they could meet in New York. I met him several years ago. And anyway, we were both exploring different venues for, and we weren't saying we had to be together, but it made more sense. I went up my one trip. I've been housebound now for 15 years here, but I made one trip last year. We were inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in New York, and I had somebody, a niece of mine, who went up with me, and the flight was very well arranged and everything, because I can't get around hardly at all. And So at that time, Tom and I were talking the night of the awards thing that we really should be sure our papers all go to the same place. So much of what we've done through the years is such overlapping stuff. I mean, a lot of it's visual stuff that I've done, a lot of drawings and paintings and things when we were working on shows. It's a lot interesting collaboration in many ways. And I mean, it would stand totally on its own for either one of us, but I think it's nice to keep it all together if we can. And so that's what we're working on right now, and I think this may work out. And I'm sorry, I'm heeding my secretary of 50 years saying, don't you dare do this.
Well, it's good.
So this will pique your interest, and
yes, it will.
Perhaps not. It'll probably kill the whole thing.
Before that, that last trip to New York that you mentioned, was the last time you were here, Harvey, was that when you and Tom did your show at the York Theater?
Oh, this induction into the Songwriters Hall of Fame was a total thing into itself. It's an annual thing there.
No, but I'm just asking, was the last time you were in New York, was it when you and Tom did The Show Goes On?
It was getting close, because I even had trouble. I had a fake walking out to get to the piano there.
Oh, yeah.
And so the last thing that we did together would have been that, yes. And I'm glad we got that done and recorded. It was a wonderful experience. I loved doing it and getting the record, too.
Is it somewhat overwhelming when you are going through your papers to see how much work you've done in a lifetime?
It is, truly.
And do you find things that you say, oh, I don't remember this at all, but when did this happen?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's just endless stuff, because Tom and I both, when we're writing or doing our thing, we do endless amounts of work on it individually and then together, too. So, and I always do drawings. It helps me when I'm composing to sort of visualize what I think things might look like and remind me what the show is or what we're working on. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff. And it's really, I think, more than anyone will probably want when we dump it all on them. But the guy who we're dealing with now, it seems very interested about getting it all. I'm sorry, you had asked me a question. I don't think I answered.
Well, I asked if you found things that you had said, oh, I don't remember this, and you did talk about that. But
a lot of songs, you know. Luckily, through the years, don't tell him, I can't remember his name, but on the West Coast, this guy did all these cut songs albums, you know. Bruce Kimmel, one of my oldest, dearest friends. Don't tell him, like, his name didn't pop right up. He's not even a 1940s movie star. Anyway, I'm so pleased. Because some of those songs on those records, I'm so glad they're done. And there's some very good songs on them. And I let him pick whatever he wanted to do, and he liked a lot of the things on his own. And chose who would sing them and everything. It was a nice period in my life.
Bruce has visited us on this program before, and
that's great.
We've talked about his Lost in Boston series and all the work that he did at Vervez and then Finsworth, and now Critcherland.
Kimmeland.
No, it's terrific. You know, like Ben Bagley's thing he did was very, I realized I wasn't doing the drawings eventually, that it was a great thing he was doing, these unorthodox recordings, and really fascinating by sometime major stars like Katharine Hepburn and Betty Davis, who you didn't think could sing, you know. And but then also, Bruce really liked a lot of these songs from other shows, you know, he really did. And he knew them all. He spent years collecting them, and he was great to work with too. I loved getting to know him, and now that I've spoken to you, I'm going to actually call him on the phone. I never call anyone on the phone anymore, but just to talk to him again.
Yeah, Bruce is doing an online television series type of thing that's running online. It's a very interesting project that he's working on right now. Among his men, you know, he's always got a million oars in the fire as well.
Yes, I think the last time I talked to him, he was talking about that, And I'm very glad he's always active, and he does a lot of writing on his own, too, mystery books and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. So, Harvey, thank you so much for spending some time with us. We hope that the storm has passed in Texas, and you will you'll be able to go outside and
Well, I don't think I can go outside.
No, maybe not go outside, but at least look outside and see.
I have a lot of windows here, so I'm looking at it. It's great to talk to y'all, and I appreciate so much you wanted to get in contact with me.
Absolutely.
And I'm sorry I rambled so, but that's the stage I'm at.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Well, you know.
I didn't have to think of any of your names.
So. All right, Harvey. Well, you have a great evening. And
You too. It's so nice of you to do this, and I appreciate it.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye. Bye-bye.
When the moon was young, when the month was May, when the stage was hung for my holiday, I saw shining lights, but I never knew they were you, they were you, they were you.
Wow, that's a slice of history to have Harvey come in and join us for some time and talk about his career. Peter and Michael got a chance to see The Cradle Will Rock over at Encores. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
I'm crazy about The Cradle Will Rock, the 1937 Mark Blitzstein work that was shut down by the government, and yet Orson Welles and John Houseman were not going to take this lying down. They found a new theater up the street. There was a 20-odd block march where they opened. And, of course, because Actors' Equity said you couldn't have actors on stage because they were actually government employees, all the actors sat in the audience. And when the time came for them to do their parts, they simply stood up in their chairs. Well, Mark Blitzstein, not a member of Equity, was on stage playing the piano. It has to be one of the greatest nights in the history of the American theater, maybe even world theater. But the work itself is wonderful. It's certainly agitprop, no question about it. It takes place in Steel Town, where Mr. runs everything and is not going to let that go. So the priest in town, Reverend Salvation, and the newspaper mogul editor, Daily. So it's all that, you know, it's very agitprop. And they're all under his thumb. And Larry Foreman does not want to be and will not be. He has the chance to sell out, believe me. But he knows that this is not something he wants to do. And he is going to make sure that he is going to unionize the people who need to be unionized in Steel Town so that Mr. Will not reign for the long term. Now, of course, time has passed, and here we are, you know, many moons later, and we're living in a country where we hear the thing about 1% of the people have 99% of the wealth, you know, so I don't think The Cradle Will Rock really succeeded terribly well in doing its aims, but the work itself is really, really intoxicating musically. I will admit the lyrics are occasionally clunky, and but I'm very, very taken with the music in it. So I was looking forward to this like crazy. And this is one of those shows where it happens every now and then, where the moment the people went on stage, it was over for me. I knew I wasn't going to like it. The moment, because they were all dressed in tuxedos. Now, this is not a show. Granted, some of the cast deals with Mr.'s well-to-do friends. And yeah, they could be in tuxedos. But good Lord, the prostitute who starts the show certainly shouldn't be dressed in a formal gown. Now, you might say, well, that's what Encore does. You know, they do them in formal clothes. No, they really
not
don't.
Not anymore, no.
I mean, and, you know, we wondered when Hair was being produced there if they were going to use tuxedos, and of course they did not, you know. So there's no need for that whatsoever. And then I thought, well, at least, you know, when Raul Esparza shows up as Larry Foreman, he'll be in our regular clothes. No. There was also a great deal of doubling that was confusing, but more to the point, it was treated in such a silly fashion by Sam Gold, who had a child playing a police. I mean, a real child. I mean, a kid. I don't think he's hit 10 yet. Playing a policeman. And Mr.'s daughter was played by a guy in drag, you know, and things like that. It was very, very gimmicky, and it didn't need to be. And it really seemed to me to bring out that old cliche we've heard a million times, but we use it more and more as time goes on. He didn't trust the material. So I didn't like it at all, even though the people were fine. Anika Ranoni Rose, wonderful, you know, singing her songs, you know, really, really top notch. It was nice to see so many journeyman actors up there who were really terrific performers. is Henry Stram, you know, is a wonderful actor who is one of those people you recognize when you see him. You may not know his name. So I don't blame the people who were in the show. They were doing what they were told. But I would have liked a more straightforward directorial concept and less gimmick.
So, Michael, what did you think?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I don't know where to start. I agree about the music, which I find extraordinary. Some really beautiful stuff. I interviewed Raul Esparza prior to the opening, and he said that correctly that there's some very, very beautiful music, because this is a show that you know, the legend of the show is much, much, much more famous than the actual show itself. We did get some of it, some of the songs in the Tim Robbins film about that momentous opening night, which was called Cradle Will Rock, not The Cradle Will Rock. I don't know, I guess maybe just to distinguish it from the piece itself. And that was a very interesting film, although not 100% historically accurate, somewhat fictionalized. But yes, I agree. The Mark Blitzstein's music is really, really runs the gamut. Some of it is wonderfully beautiful and lyrical, and then there's a lot of many spiky moments. It's funny. It's this show is more Brechtwilian than anything Brechtweil wrote, I would say, or at least as much so. It's very the harmonies, you know, all of the kind of devices you associate with the Brechtweil musicals, and I noticed when I interviewed Raul, I mentioned that there's a lot of I think that a lot of it was drawn upon for Urinetown.
Oh sure, yeah.
You know, in particular, the Bobby Strong character seems very, very much like Larry Forman. But it's a fascinating piece. And Blitzstein, the thing is, yeah, I certainly also agree with you about the lyrics, Peter. But I guess I didn't really understand why he set so many of the lyrics in such a deliberately, you know, off kilter way. I suppose that is part of the whole alienation effect. But I don't know if that was really necessary, and certainly not to that degree. It distracted me. I would describe it more as a distraction than what maybe it was intended to do. So that really did kind of surprise me. But the music itself is absolutely beautiful. It would be amazing if there's a recording of this production, which...
Yeah, if I could shut my eyes, I could have, of course. But, I mean, you know, then I would have enjoyed it substantially more.
Yeah.
But they were wide open out of astonishment.
Yeah. This we should say this production had amazing new orchestrations by Josh
great.
Clayton, and there again, aside from everything else, one of the other reasons that The Cradle Will Rock is so historic is that some people consider it the Broadway show to have had the first original cast recording. Some people don't consider it you know, legit in that sense, because it is only the piano. The one piano version. It doesn't have the orchestrations that were originally planned. And so some people say it's Oklahoma. Some people say it's, you know, it's certain other shows. Right. But certainly one of the first original cast recordings is The Cradle Will Rock.
Another reason why that's up to debate is because I'm not sure that recording was really, really sold at the time.
Oh.
You know, I think it was like given out or given to cast members and that type of thing. It's a terrific recording, by the way. It really, especially in Joe Work Against Jip, there are some very interesting riffs on that song there in that recording. But, you know, what I also thought of while I was watching this on Saturday was the fact that given that this was the first cast album, it's very interesting that there were three then considered naughty words on it. Jesus, bastard, And I guess Damn or Hell, I forget which, but I mean, that was, you know, hot stuff in those days, and you didn't hear those on recordings. And I guess that sort of set the tone for original cast albums to come, you know, because, we certainly did get some naughty words on original cast albums much sooner than we did on, pop records, though, of course, pop records today, you know, have certainly eclipsed us. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen now that we're out of swears. I mean, you know, because the Book of Mormon using the C word, that's it. You know, I mean, what's left? I mean, I do not know of any other swears. So we're going to, somebody should really start inventing some new one.
Yeah. If we need that.
Right. That's really important.
But getting back to, yes. And, this production, yeah, Sam Gold directed it, as Peter said, and I have not seen much of Sam Gold's work, but I have seen a few things. And I guess they thought of him because they said to themselves, well, we need somebody who's going to do odd stuff, because that's the kind of show it is. I mean, Look Back in Anger at the Roundabout was a very notable example of that. There were some very interesting, very, very strange staging things that were done in that production. Even Picnic, the Broadway, the most recent revival of Picnic, it was very realistic in many ways, but then he had this incredibly strange wooden wall going along the back of the stage that, you know, just as if to like throw a wrench in the verisimilitude of it. So I think, I mean, I can only speculate, but I think that's maybe why he was hired for The Cradle of Rock. But I think it was absolutely the wrong choice, because the piece itself, you know, is so Brechtian and it has so many unusual methods of trying to get its story across. And if on top of that you bring in somebody who's going to cast a child as the cop and do all of this odd doubling. I don't know if you've mentioned this specifically, Peter, but the role of the prostitute was doubled with the role of Mrs. Mister, like the polar opposite characters, and both were played very well by by Anika Nani Rose. But you know, it's, and I guess he was trying to make some kind of point there, but I just kind of felt like everything was really, really gilding the lily, and I think a much more straightforward version, especially since, you know, as I always say, I mean, if you're going to do the 900th production of Fiddler on the Roof or Gypsy, you might, I think you have maybe more latitude to, you know, to do something creative and not what was done before and not what the authors necessarily intended. But if you have something that's so incredibly rare as this, I just think that's a really, really big mistake.
And there were handheld mics, and so much of the show involved one actor passing the mic to another actor, passing it to another actor. Give everybody a mic, will you please, if you're going to do that? I mean, this is the worst use of mics I've seen since Spring Awakening. I mean, I just couldn't, it was just so stupid. So that was a problem for me, too.
Agreed. And I had heard about the evening dress thing before seeing the show. I could not imagine how that could possibly work or why he could ever have decided that that was a good idea. But I said, well, let me actually see it before I make a judgment. And my judgment is it was a ridiculous idea.
You know, when they did Anyone Could Whistle at Carnegie Hall.
The previous one.
The GMHC benefit.
Yeah, right. Yes.
And Scott Bakula, they did everything in black tie and it was very interesting because Scott Bakula wore black tie, but he wore sneakers. He wore Keds or something like that. And it just so fit that role.
Sure. Okay.
And so there's a way to do that. And I wonder if it was a cost issue and they just really wanted to make sure that they didn't get caught, you know, trying to, you know, go on the cheap a little bit. You know, you put everybody in black tie and that makes it very simple and inexpensive to do it versus trying to costume it on the cheap. And I don't know. it just doesn't sound like, and the handing off of mics, those all sound like budget constraints.
I don't know. Maybe, but I don't think so, James. I mean, because the costumes they would have actually worn would, you know, would not have been, you know, people literally could have.
Yeah, what do you got in your closet? Yeah.
So I don't know. And yeah, the microphone thing, I think it was just another attempt to remind us that this is a performance, and that was his interpretation of the alienation effect. There were things that I'm not sure if they're in the script. Perhaps, Peter, you might know. Is it in the script that people are supposed to hold up cards that say funny phrases, you know, that comment on the actions?
No.
Yeah, I don't know. That was a really unfortunate thing, because poor David Margulies got his cards out of order at the performance. And actually, yeah, I guess we were at the same performance, weren't we, Peter?
Let's hope so.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it played from July 10th to the 13th, and it is in the past. So as we mentioned before, hopefully they turn the recorders on and connect it to the soundboard, and we'll have something to look forward to in the future. But
I'm sure they at least do that for archival purposes. But maybe this might be something, because of its historic significance, that might get a commercial recording.
Yeah. Wasn't it?
Raoul was awfully good.
Excellent.
Yeah.
It seems like.
And Judy Kuhn, you know,
quite the cast.
I am so glad to see Judy Kuhn back, you know, in the game. I thought she was fantastic. And I always forget, you know, how wide-ranging her voice is, and aside from how beautiful it is. It really was an amazing cast. Danny Burstein, Matthew Saldivar, I thought, did a terrific job. Martin Moran. I mean, you know, we just could go on and on.
Yeah, it seems like quite the cast. All right, so let's move forward. And Peter got a chance to see three shows at the Nymph, the New York Musical Theater Festival. Why don't we start off with Life Could Be a Dream.
This is a musical by Roger Bean. It's a jukebox musical. He's done quite a few of them. And the one we know best in New York is The Marvelous Wonderettes, which did seem to, during the first act, to just be another retread of the taffetas, in which women sang songs from the 50s in their most glorious dress that they wore to the prom. And it turned out to be a little more interesting than that, because the second act was 10 years later. And you saw how pop music had changed for women in just 10 years, as opposed to Mr. Sandman, Bring Me a Dream, the first act. The second act was You Don't Own Me. You know, so Roger Bean is a very clever man, and I think the show is quite good, Life Could Be a Dream, because you really come to care about the characters. I didn't expect that to happen as strongly as it did. It's simply a story you've heard a million times about a guy who works as a mechanic for a boss whose daughter he likes, and she likes him, and it seems that their love could never be. Sounds terrible, doesn't it? I understand, and when you think the fact that you're hearing songs that you've heard a million times before in the pop market from the 50s, which is when it's set, that it's not going to be very good. There's another story, too, going on, in which these young kids want to develop a group so that they can win a contest for a new singing group, a recording contract, and all that goes with that. And those two stories dovetail okay, but my point is that really, I really got invested in the story. Part of it, too, is because there's an actor named Doug Carpenter, who was so wonderful in this show, playing the mechanic. And one of the reasons he's wonderful is because he's not acting, if you know what I mean. I mean, he doesn't he seems so natural up there. That's what's so wonderful about him. So for his performance alone, it's certainly worth seeing. But the show's worth seeing anyway, and I had a very good time at it, and I wish it well.
I'm looking at Doug Carpenter's bio here, and it seems like he's got lots of, he's from the West Coast, it seemingly is, and he's went to UCLA, and has done a lot of West Coast leading roles, and so hopefully he's somebody we can watch for in New York here.
Yeah, this show has had a Los Angeles tryout, and now they're here, and I won't be the slightest bit surprised if it gets picked up, and it's Roger Bean's newest hit.
All right, next we have Julian Poe, that you saw at the Nymph as well, so why don't you tell us about that?
This one's pretty good. Andrew Barrett wrote the book and lyrics, and Ira Antelis was the composer. It's the score is very country western bluegrass type thing, and the score is really wonderful. I mean, it's a CD I hope to get sooner rather than later, because it's got that tub thumping, gut thumping music that, but it's with theatrical sound. I mean, think the same type of thing that Whorehouse achieved, you know, sounding country western, but on the other hand, you know, still sounding theatrical. So these guys have done a very good job there. It's about a town. Well, no, yeah, it is about a town. It's about a guy coming into a town, but it's really about the town as well. He wanted to go to the West Coast to the sea because he can't swim, and he's going to drown himself. He's going to kill himself. His life has been so meaningless that it's just pointless to go on. It's just not going to happen anymore. And people become fascinated with him. And given the fact that he is going to die soon, they figure they're safe in telling all their secrets to him. And that's what they do. And he winds up changing their lives. And so it's a very interesting story. And the fact that Chad Kimball plays Julian Poe, the guy who comes to town, certainly makes a big impression as well. Also, Malcolm Getz is in as well as a priest who starts questioning religion after talking to Julian Poe for a little while. So that's what it's about. It's about how one guy can change a town. Now, Jeff Sweet, the excellent dramatist and teacher, often says, in any musical where a stranger comes to town, one of two things can happen. Either he becomes assimilated in the community or they get rid of him. I'm not going to tell you what happens to Julian Poe because I think you will see this in the future because it's such a solid show. But nevertheless, yes, indeed, one of those two things happen. And that's where I draw the line in telling you anymore. But a quality work, and I wish it well.
Yeah, unfortunately, it did close yesterday on the 14th. It did its performances already the 8th through the 14th at Nymph. Dan Fortune had asked us if we'd have some of the creative team and others on the podcast. We couldn't fit him into the schedule, but it certainly seems like it might show up again in the future.
I think it will. I think it will, yeah.
All right, and to round out our triple play for the evening, you saw the Swiss Family Robinson at Nymph as well. So tell us about that.
Yes, this is another show, like Cradle Will Rock, well, production, where the first moment it's over, you say to yourself, okay, this is going to stink. Because they come out and they start singing to you, the whole cast starts singing to you, have you ever been shipwrecked? Well, no, of course we haven't. I mean, you know, how many people, what kind of question is that? Have you ever been shipwrecked? I mean, you know, musicals are best when they connect with you and you can identify them and all that kind of stuff. Most of the people who have been shipwrecked died. You know, the rest of them, the survivors, probably aren't in a musical. So what are the chances that people are going to say, oh, yeah, I can relate to this story, you know, that type of thing. This show has more characters than Rags. I'm telling you, every time you turn around, there's a new person being introduced and all that. And it's just god-awful to see stories abandoned, just as Swiss Family Robinson is abandoned. I mean that. I mean, that's what the show's called. But I'm telling you, there's a long stretch in the second act where they are completely forgotten because you're dealing with natives on the island, you're dealing with French people. I'm telling you, every time you turn around, somebody new. The French guy is played as vainglorious, and it's one of those terrible conceptions where he's silly. You know, he thinks he's the sun and the moon, and he's silly. These guys who wrote this show should really take and the director, too, should take a look at Camelot, where indeed Lancelot thought a lot of himself, too, but he was never silly. Moss Hart wouldn't let it happen. Alan J. Lerner wouldn't let it happen. Sure, he's got that song, C'est Moi, that is very funny. You know, but nevertheless, he's never silly. This guy, a French guy with the same sensibility, was played as silly. So this is a result of three people named Kennedy. John Kennedy, Walter Kennedy, and Patrick Kennedy. So Walter and Patrick and Jack, you know, the Kennedys doing this show. I think they need somebody other than a Kennedy in there to help them out because the music, however, is very nice. The music, this guy knows what show music needs to sound like. So we're all set there. But, you know, I don't know the original property. For all I know, there are all these characters in the Swiss Family Robinson. I mean, there are native girls who don't know they're girls because they don't know there's another sex. And there's the head of the of them, who a woman who rather resembles Hermione Gingle, that type of thing. And then, and at the end, somebody comes on at the last 4 seconds, and it turns out to be her long-lost love. I mean, it's a mess. It's a mess. Maybe this is what Swiss Family Robinson is really like. But certainly, they lost my patience from the very beginning, and I was amazed that I even had any for the other 2 hours and 20 minutes, which seemed substantially longer. I swore that when I looked at my watch, I expected it to be 2 hours and 45 minutes. So that's not a good sign either.
So I'm looking at their Nymph page, and their cast and crew goes on and on and on. There seems to be lots and lots of people in this production. How'd they all fit in the tree? That's what I want to know.
Well, I guess I could say, if you want to think positive, I would say 2 out of 3 ain't bad. You really liked 2 of those 3 shows.
Yeah, your first, indeed. Yeah. Indeed. And you know, how often does that happen at Nymph? You know, so sure.
Well, that's great. So I guess that's kind of should wrap it up for the evening. You guys want to mention anything coming up?
I'm going to see Hello, Dolly! At Goodspeed.
Oh, yeah.
Which I may have mentioned. Really, really looking forward to it, with Clea Blackhurst and Tony Sheldon and Ashley Brown. And it's supposed to be quite good.
When are you going?
Saturday afternoon.
Mm-hmm. I'm going Wednesday night, I think.
Oh, that's the press opening, yeah.
I think so. I think I'm going to try to get there then. So we'll have a lot to say about that next week.
Great. Excellent. I'm looking forward to hearing about that. Michael, how are you getting up there?
Well,
is there mass transit?
No. I mean, that's, you know, I could do an hour on this subject. It's so hard to get to without a car. A bunch of us are renting a car. And we thought that since it is so far, that a matinee would be more advisable.
You came on 2 buses and a train.
Yeah.
All right. There's put away $2.75 in your pocket, because there's a great ice cream place right there.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Get some ice cream. Ice cream solves everything. All right. So I want to remind everybody that you could subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you would, stop by iTunes and leave some reviews for us, because reviews will help other listeners find our show that have never heard of it before, and it will raise our rankings on Apple's iTunes list. So please do that if you can. If you'd like to listen to us in other ways, you can listen to us on the Stitcher app. That's an application for your iPhone, your iPad, your any of your Apple devices, or your Android devices, or your Blackberries, and it'll stream to you. Or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. At BroadwayRadio.com, there are links to some of the things we've talked about today, a bunch of links for Harvey and the Cradle of Rock and other things like that. So please check those out as well. And there's also contact information for Peter, Michael, and me. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.